Hi. So thank you for coming today. My name is Tom Easton. I'm with The Economist. I'm just going to very briefly introduce Paul Schulte. My friend Tara Joseph is on the board too. We're very happy to bring him here today. I would say as a reporter, you know, you have to make calls all the time, as those of you in the press know. And many of these calls are just, they are just excruciating. These are people you don't want to call, and you don't want to hear from, and you don't want to take notes about what they say. And when I retire, it will be the happiest day just because. But then there's a very small group of people that you always want to call, and you always want to hear from. Because whatever they say, whether you agree with it or not, is always interesting and always scintillating. And this is important for the crowd today. You can always argue with them. So there is no better example of that than Paul Schulte, who's currently at China Construction Bank, previously at Nomura, previously at Lehman. The important thing I want in this lunch is please take notes about what he says, figure out what you object to, and then mercilessly attack him at the end. He is a grown-up, and he can handle all of your questions, and the better, the more trenchant, the more difficult your questions, the better this presentation will be. So with that, you know, just to set him up as a pinata before you slam him around, Paul will come up and make his presentation. So thank you.
Great. So I get to be the pinata today. Well, thanks, everybody. Great to be here and appreciate the invite. I guess we can see on these two screens here the bulk of the presentation. I just want to make one point. When you try to, some of us watch this Discovery Channel, and there's this show called The Universe that gives us these mind-boggling things about how gravity works and how difficult it is to explain gravity. Well, what I want to talk about today is kind of the gravity of credit, because there's gravitational forces at work today in the world that are pulling down the West, and they're pushing up emerging markets, and these are forces that are pretty much inexorable and are very, very difficult to counter. And that's what I want to talk about, is the way in which these forces are exceptionally strong and are causing a powerful, and I would say irreversible, upward pressure in asset prices in Hong Kong, in China, in a lot of Asia, and are causing irresistible falls in asset prices in the West, even though central banks are trying to prop them up. And I think that's what this is all about. And so the title of my presentation today is that these things that are falling are going to land. And when something is sort of a flame and it's trying to land, you have to put tarmac. On the tarmac, you have to put foam to prevent that spark from turning into a bursting into flames. And that's what quantitative easing is all about. And so what I want to talk about is the inevitable descent of many of these asset prices in the West, at the same time that we should and need to expect identical forces pushing up asset prices in Asia. And so that's the whole theme of what I want to talk about today. And probably the best way I could describe this is symptomatic of the announcement yesterday by the S&P downgrading or warning of a downgrade to negative on the S&P on the warning for the United States of America. And so how do we look at the world? This is the best way I can look at the world. This is not a very good, not a very strong red the dot here. But anyway, on the upper left is the West. And you can see there on this is that we have current accounts and we have loan to deposit ratio. Note their relationship. All I'm saying here is something very simple. In order for countries to really go to town in terms of creating current account deficits of spending and buying more than they have, you're going to have to go to an outside foreigner to get credit to do that. And when that number goes above one on the y-axis, the number goes below zero on the x-axis. And that's basically saying I need to have credit from somebody else in order to grow beyond my ability. And that's where the world finds itself right now. The US and the pigs are two of the most leveraged, indebted, entities in the world, and the S&P told us on Monday morning this has got to come down one way or the other. And on the flip side, you can see on the extreme right that Southeast Asia, Switzerland, Northeast Asia, Germany, and China are on the extreme opposite, where they have an extremely low amount of leverage in their financial system, and of course they have current account surpluses, which means they have tremendous amounts of liquidity. And the longer you have that plane coming down, the more the West has to keep rates at zero to prevent this plane from crashing. The longer that rates stay at zero, the more it pushes up Asia. That's what's going on right in front of our eyes, and this is going to continue. And the vast bulk of everything you see here on the right-hand side is Asia. Now, the same thing is true, again, very, very simple chart, consumption and leverage. Guess what? Everyone's talking about a consumption boom in China. I guarantee you there is no consumption boom in any country in the world without credit. So in fact, that shows you that slope of that line from our high school algebra, y equals x. For every increase in consumption, you have to have an increase in credit. That's the deal on credit cards, mortgages, layaway, layaway for white goods, you name it, personal loans. This is what happens in the world, and we can see there that on the extreme upper right side, again, this is the S&P warning. The U.S. being at that extreme upper right side is unsustainable. Something has to give. And as that gives, the Federal Reserve has to stay there and keep this plane from bursting into flames as it lands on the ground. Conversely, China is having tremendous upward pressure on consumption at the same time, because China's at the extreme bottom left. And so what we're seeing in the last 12 months right in front of our eyes is exactly what is going on. And I think this chart pretty much tells us a lot of what's going on. Similarly, guess what? You can look at the whole world, and you can see that line there, which shows you that the higher your loan to deposit ratio goes, the higher your consumption goes. And that's why I think what we're going to see in front of our eyes in the next few years is virtually a guaranteed boom in consumption, especially in the west and center of China, based upon very simple math. This is not like you know, a stretch. This is what happens to economies. As consumption grows, credit grows. If your credit can grow, your consumption grows. China's credit levels are coming off of all-time record lows from about 18 months ago. So China's one of the least indebted domestic financial systems in the world. And you can see here, in this group here, Australia would be the one that makes me the most worried, followed by Brazil. So if you want something to worry about Brazil and Australia, not China. Same thing here. This is kind of a similar dynamic with currencies. This gives us a lot of hints about currencies. Because essentially what we have here also shows you that the two most undervalued currencies in that group are Singapore and China. And that the most overvalued would be arguably the US dollar, Spain, Australia, the UK, France, and Korea. And then down here on the bottom here, you'd see Japan, Canada, and Hong Kong being very undervalued currencies. Everyone says, why is leverage so low in Asia? Leverage is so low in Asia, leverage is so low in Asia. You can see there, that was the Asian crisis right there in 1997, 98. All I'm saying when credit gets to be above 100 is I have to borrow from a foreigner. I have to get money from a foreigner to fund my economy when my number goes above 100. And when it does, you're beholden to the kindness of strangers. You know, that's the deal with leverage. And when that bubble pops, and by the way, that star is Europe today. So Europe, arguably, is in worse shape right now than Asia was in 1997. And when that bubble pops, foreigners take away all their money and they go home. They don't want to, they're in, this is the too hard category, they want to leave, they want to go. And so this is what happens, your banking system collapses, and as long as the banking system collapses, as it did in Asia until 2004, two things are guaranteed. Your banks underperform that whole period, and property prices get murdered. That's why really it took until 2004 for the Hong Kong property market to recover, and the Thai market, and the Indonesian market. That was 7 years of recovery. And so essentially what we talk about is kind of a 4 to 7 year window of recovery that you need in order to have your property market begin to crater, bottom out, and then begin to move up. And we are basically in year number two in the West. So I feel pretty confident in saying there's an awful lot of glass to crawl over, and that's why I feel very confident that people talking about the end of QE, I think, are out of their minds. And Bernanke hinted at that today. Last night he said, we're not quite ready, even though we might be, but we're not. You know, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth because they know that if you look at that chart I put up a couple of minutes ago, the U.S. is at one of the extremes in the world of the most leveraged, most consumed, most current account deficited economies in the world. And if you're telling me that the deleveraging process is finished, you're kidding yourself. It hasn't even begun yet. And the Fed knows this. And so here's the world, right? A lot of the philosophers talk about, you know, what drives human behavior, pain and pleasure. Getting as much pleasure as possible and avoiding the pain. The pain of deleveraging is really bad. And so these guys right here, number one is Portugal. Number two is Ireland. Number two is the US. And you have to include Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Spain, the UK, and then Brazil, which everybody loves right now. So, you know, again, red alert. Italy, and then on the other side, the least leveraged economy in the world is China, followed by Canada, Indonesia, HSBC, Singapore, and then here would be the US banking system without the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's the deal. And so when you're re-leveraging, that's pleasure, man. That's great. Because your asset prices are under huge pressure to go up. And your currency tends to be undervalued. And on the left-hand side, you're getting a crushing, you have a steamroller of deleveraging. Banks are calling in loans. They are, governments are raising taxes. Governments are cutting entitlement programs, and it's real pain. And you have a big government turnover. You have a high turnover rate of government in deleveraging economies. Japan, deleveraging economies tend to be very unstable politically. And I'll just do a little aside here. The root cause of political instability is the absence of credit. And I can prove it. And here we go individually in terms of the countries. Again, I want to take this a little bit further and a very simple chart, ladies and gentlemen. Again, the x-axis is your loan to deposit ratio. And the y-axis is how much you as an investor are paying for this country's banking system. Who's the cheapest banking system in the world right now? Japan. Japan's banking system is trading as if it's being liquidated. Below 5 cents, you are basically being told your system is under liquidation. And that's why there's a lot of interest in this in the Japanese banks, if people can figure out how long it will take to safely bury this Fukushima nuclear power plant. The second cheapest in the world is China. This is the fact that right now people are basically paying about 12 cents for every $1 of deposits for China. Brazil is one of the most expensive in the world, followed by Indonesia, India, and Mexico, and Turkey. Which one do I want to own? China. I don't want to own the Brazilian banks. I don't want to own Indian banks right now. Right? And then over here, here's your pigs, right? These are all extremely leveraged: Portugal, Spain, Ireland, Greece, UK, Australia. These six make me very nervous because they can only do one thing, and that's shrink. That's the gravitational force that's pulling you down. And the guys over here have a gravitational force that's pulling them up. And that line shows you what tends to happen to stock prices, that stock prices after about 100 will tend to collapse, that the market will punish you if your banking system has a high loan-to-deposit ratio. Here's a clean picture of Asia. Again, just looking at Japan here as, again, the cheapest banking system in the world. If people have confidence that encasing the Fukushima plant in cement will contain and eliminate groundwater contamination and soil contamination, the Japanese banks are some of the best buys in the world. Very few people can say that right now. And people feel very uncomfortable about this whole issue because no one knows the way in which water and soil damage in Japan is what status that is in. China's here in Hong Kong. So China and Hong Kong would be the least leveraged and the cheapest banking systems. Korea would be the most leveraged. And therefore, some people consider it a value trap because it's hard for the Korean banks to grow. That's why they have really cruddy ROE. They have really cruddy return on equity, which is like 8-9% all the time. It's hard for them to grow because the Koreans don't save. The Koreans are, you know, considered the Brazilians of Asia. Brazil has a very low savings rate relative to everybody else. And then these guys in the middle, HSBC is I think, really interesting value relative to Standard Chartered. And then India and Indonesia are just, can you imagine Indonesia is the most expensive banking system in the world, along with Brazil? It's really fascinating. That Indonesia was the nadir of you know banking incompetence you know 6 years ago, and now it is the most expensive banking system in Asia. Amazing. And then here's currencies, you guys. We plug this in, and all this comes together. Excess consumption, high credit will lead to overvalued currencies because people use all this credit to buy homes, they buy up assets, they make the country very expensive, and therefore the currency is overvalued. It's very common sense. And therefore, if you look at the, which I love, the Big Mac Index, which alarmingly is very similar to the IMF fair value of currencies. So I wonder if the IMF is looking out of the right side of their eye at the Big Mac Index to get some of their currency valuations. But you can see here, Brazil, Europe, Australia, the most overvalued currencies in the world. Hong Kong, China, Malaysia, Thailand, the most undervalued currencies in the world. And again, all the same thing, the gravitational forces forcing up one and forcing down the other. That's it. I hope the pictures were helpful, and I'm happy to take any questions. So go for the pinata. I'm happy to do that. Yeah.
Can everyone hear me? You can take questions sitting down or standing up. Yeah, everyone can hear, right? Normally, I don't start with questions because I'm sitting right next to the speaker, but two things you said I wanted to follow up on. Your last comment was you said about Indonesia, not long ago or whatever, it was the most incompetent banking system in the world. Now it's the most expensive. And my question in that regard is, does that have anything to do with its competence or incompetence, or is it other factors that have led? It could be both. The second is, you said you can prove the root cause of political instability is the absence of credit. And that's such a profound statement that I would, give you. So those two questions. But meanwhile, everyone who's got a question, please raise your hand like now so I can see where it is and I can begin calling on everybody.
Yeah, real quickly, if you look at Indonesia, when you have a credit crisis, it's like a volcano going off. You know, there is absolutely, you know, breathtaking, unbelievable damage. But the aftermath of a volcano is some of the richest soil in the world. And so let me give you an example. In 2001, Bank Niaga came out of the crisis with 95% of its balance sheet was government bonds. That's going to happen, by the way, in a lot of banks in Europe in the next 3 years. And so when you begin to recover, your bank becomes this phenomenal warrant on the country's stability. And the Indonesian rupiah fell like 90%. The stock market was down literally 94%. It's hard for a stock market to go down that much, but Indonesia fell in dollar terms 94%. And Indonesia only got back to its old all-time high in dollar terms like 6 months ago. So it took, you know, 12 years for Indonesia in dollar terms to get back to its old all-time high. So that's basically kind of a generation. And so what happens is when you come out of that, you get these extremely low loan-to-deposit ratios, ultra-conservative regulators, and that's a great point. Low leverage and low loan-to-deposit ratios can cover an awful big multitude of sins. Right, and high loan-to-deposit ratios expose every peccadillo and stupidity you can imagine. And that's the deal with China, right? I mean, people who are talking about China imploding tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock are just, you know, don't understand leverage because you've got a capacity in China, even to get to 80% loan-to-deposit ratio, which is still 50 points away from the West, that's $2 trillion in credit, right? So China has a phenomenal firepower to safely distribute credit, which is right now equal to 50% of GDP. The second point is a great book. David Shamba wrote that wonderful book called China's Communist Party, and he did a fantastic analysis of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and he made this amazing point about the retardation of economic activity and the breaking of the banking system as one of the causes of economic instability and political instability. And I think that's so profoundly true. If you go back and look at all the political instability we have in the world, where is it? Right? What governments keep turning over every 12 months? Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Japan, right? Unleveraged economies don't have problems, and therefore the governments don't turn over. The problems don't happen until you get those really, really dangerously high loan-to-deposit ratios of 120, 130, 140. I will give any person in this room $100 if you can show me a loan-to-deposit ratio country of 60 that blows up. I will give you $100 out of my pocket right now. You can't. It doesn't happen. It happens when the loan-to-deposit ratio gets to 120, 130, 150. Every one of the pigs is somewhere like 130 to 150, every single one of them. The UK, 130, right? France, 120, right? The only country in Europe with a low LDR is Germany. That's why Germany's banking system is considered to be pretty okay.
Do you know what the loan-to-deposit ratios are in the Middle East?
I don't, but I can find out. Well, I mean, in some of these places...
I just want to put my claim in. For $100.
Some of these places don't even have functioning banking systems.
That's the excuse, right? Okay, I think I saw, was there a question? Yes, right here. This, please, oh.
Look at the chart.
Oh, yeah, where's
yeah. Yeah, you can speak right into here. I'm sorry, we have both of them.
Just looking at the chart where you, you know, Asian crisis in 97, mm-hmm. path to recovery. Do you see a similar path for Europe?
I guess that's my point, is it's very, very difficult not to have that happen. Very, very, very difficult. And you know what? Central banks are going to try to make that line stay up for a long time. And my point is, central banks can change the trajectory of that line, but they cannot reverse it. So that's a great point you make. The ECB is trying to make that line go sideways to avoid political instability or to avoid the collapse of some of these countries like Portugal or Greece or Ireland. And some people will say, who are very cynical and pessimistic and negative, they will say that the sovereign governments are going to sink themselves by trying to save their banking system rather than allowing the inevitable to happen. So the longer you try to prevent your banking system from doing what it needs to do, the more debt the government takes on, the more in jeopardy the sovereign solvency of the country is. That's Ireland's problem right now. The more Ireland tries to save its banking system, the more Ireland's own solvency is at stake. Coming from an Irish person, by the way. Yeah.
Right here. And yeah, I'll go to you after that. Please. Oh, could you also, you didn't identify yourself. We'd really like everyone to say who they are before they.
I'm Jane Singer with Inside Fashion. And I had, well, a quick first question, but then after this gentleman brought that up, I had another question that mm-hmm. came to mind. And that is that you had said
FCC,
that
you had said that
the more that these banks or countries try to save themselves, the actually worse the potential loss is. So from your point of view, would it have been better after the financial crisis to have let things fail? You know, in other words, the route they took was to try, you know, too big to fail, and you know, so on and so forth. In your point of view, would it have been better to have let things fail, take an immediate big hit, and then get on with things?
I think that would have been a catastrophic disaster. One client who's a terrific guy, a friend of mine I used to work with a long time ago, is in London. He basically said, you know, something that's very profound. He said, you know, if only they did this in 1929, we could have avoided World War II. You know, so he's onto something, because allowing the market to work, which is what we're talking about this earlier on, the Secretary of the Treasury under Herbert Hoover said, let the market clear, to hell with this. The market's going to clear, it'll be fine, let the market clear. Well, the market cleared us right into World War II. So in that sense, doing what needed to be done is probably very smart. Here's the problem. The problem is that when you have an ECB organized bailout of the European bank's ownership of Irish bonds, that is where you get into problems. Because the Irish population has figured out that they're on the hook for tens of billions of dollars worth of bonds owned by European banks. And it's like, wait a minute here. We didn't do this. Why are Irish taxpayers making whole 100 cents on the dollar all the owners of this debt that they took on voluntarily in European banks? That's the problem. And the new government in Ireland is basically saying, I'm sorry, we're not doing this. I know we said we would, but we're not going to. And so that's why you saw this big cracking yesterday in Europe yesterday, that it's like, oh my God, you know, Greece may reschedule its debt, Ireland may reschedule its debt, Portugal. Barry Eichengreen's book is out now. It's a terrific book called Exorbitant Privilege. And he wrote an article in one of these websites recently that basically said that the only way out, if you put more and more austerity on these European countries, you're just going to drive them into the ground and they're going to default anyway. So the best thing you can do, the best hope you have, is to force them to have austerity and allow them simultaneously to restructure their debt. But you have to do it at the same time, because if someone does it, someone's going to say, he got 60, huh, give me 50. And he says, he got 50, oh, I want 35. And you have to do it all at the same time or it can't work. And so he's in the forefront of a really important idea right now, which is basically, if you're going to do it fast and do it together. Because the more you try to use austerity without debt forgiveness, the more you're going to drive all these economies right into the ground. And people have pretty much figured that out last weekend.
I would go to you, but I think there's a man in front who I recognize first. Did I miss someone? Did I make a commitment? Okay. This table honors its commitments.
You
right?
Told me you're afraid of commitments.
Yeah. This man yes. Right here. Yeah. Could you identify yourself?
Hello.
And then we'll go to you.
Yep. Jason Cheng from Hodfitz. Bold statement you made. Political stability is inextricably linked with the availability of credit. I would add there's one parameter to that is time. As credit markets were developing in the 16th century, 17th century, prior to that, the whole idea of credit really wasn't, you know, in place. So for the last 400 years, we've seen a change in the financial systems. How do you know there won't be further changes that would actually change that statement that you made?
I do not know that to be the case, but what I would say is in the current Bretton Woods II system that we have, and the whole post-war world tells us, you know, with a fairly high degree of confidence that the absence of credit is a cause of political instability. If we move to puka shells or coconuts, I can't. All bets are off then. I don't know. I really don't know. But if there's some other system in the future, I really don't know. But currently, the modern era tells us very clearly that the collapse of the Soviet Union was caused by the collapse of the banking system.
If you had to put a time on it, would you say it's post the World Wars that this statement is applicable?
No. In matter of fact, you look at the 20s and the 30s, same thing. You know, when your credit system falls apart, you're in real, real deep trouble. I mean, post-World War I Germany, the credit system fell apart, and you got Hitler. The credit system completely broke. So I feel pretty confident about that.
Okay, and by the way, the press, are you all press? You should feel free to be able to ask questions as well. This is a correspondence club. We're delighted to take your questions, too.
There's a man here
so
in the back.
This man, yeah, right. But after...
Hi, Robin Fox, I'm an associate. Do you see the Eurozone breaking up? Any member states leaving?
Barry Eichengreen is an advisor to the ECB, and he writes on a really great website... which I will give to Tom, which I forget at the moment. And in his book, Exorbitant Privilege, the whole middle of the book is about the Eurozone. And he speaks to it sort of an inexorability of the Euro and a you know, multi-decade, you know, move toward cementing the Euro. So I think that the breakup of the Euro has a very low probability. The pain factor of not doing so is really, really high, and essentially, if you don't have the euro stays Ireland and Portugal and Greece and Spain will suffer a very long-term like suffocation by deflation. And that's politically creates a lot of political instability. And so if the Eurozone can cope with that, then fine. But the peripheral countries are a very small part of the overall GDP. But the political instability caused by the not only the absence of credit, the shrinkage of credit is super painful politically. Because you got to do an awful lot to take away people's, you got to take away people's wealth. You have to take away family wealth. The government is taking away family wealth as the credit system is imploding, and that's what's happening in all five countries in the PIGS.
Question right over here. Really, reporters.
My name is Peter from the Lion Rock Institute. I remember you said in the 1920s, because the government didn't intervene at that time, so that leads to World War II in the future. Which I do not agree, because we all know that at that time, the U.S. government and other government, they impose a protectionism to stop free trade. Anyway, so do you think
that was not until 1931, though. It was two years later.
Okay. So do you think QE2 has anything to do with the revolution in Middle East?
That's a great, great, great question. Excellent question. I'll tell you a quick story on that one. I was talking to an investor in Singapore who runs one of the largest funds in Singapore, who's been a friend of mine from when I was in Indonesia 22 years ago. And he met with, this is an off-the-record comment, but he met
Wait
with...
Wait a second. I got to tell you, nothing in this club is off the record.
Okay.
So
he met with a certain senior Federal Reserve member from a state that is close to New York, which might be in New York, last spring, and told him, "Are you people prepared for what's going to happen to the emerging world when the Federal Reserve, by printing money, is going to cause political instability? Are you prepared for this?" And this Federal Reserve member looked at him and said, "I don't know what on earth you're talking about." So people in the financial community have been saying this for a very long time, causing Bernanke after the presentation at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., to have to address this issue. And he had to say, what's going on in the emerging world has nothing to do with what is happening to the Federal Reserve's monetary policy. Which is, you know, methinks the lady doth protest too much, you know. And the second part of this, when I was at Nomura, we did a food vulnerability index. And if you look at the top 15 countries right now that are part of the food vulnerability index, 10 of those countries right now are having revolutions. And they're almost all in Northern Africa or the Middle East. And so I think a lot of what's going on has to do with structural shifts in demand, as you know, China and India and Indonesia are taking off in this $3,000 to $7,000 corridor. That is a tremendous burst of protein demand, and protein demand puts enormous pressure on grains and on land and on other resources to produce the beef required to satisfy this protein demand. As that happens, it so happens quantitative easing is happening at the same time that these three countries are going through that corridor. So this is kind of a perfect storm of inflationary influences, and I think that's a very fair point. Hard to prove mathematically, but fair. And the Fed will deny it.
Tara?
Well, just to take on to that point then, where do we go from here post this perfect storm, given what you see happening?
Well, I don't see, this is what I was writing about right now. I don't see what's out there that causes this to reverse course. I don't see what's out there that allows the Fed to say, wow, that was a close one, let's raise interest rates. I don't see that, right? I don't see China saying, let's have a recession, you know, to solve our problem, right? This is not going to happen. The business of government is growth, and China is on a path of 15-16% credit growth for this year. I think inflation is going to be sticky on the upside, kind of five-ish. you know, China has done a tremendous amount of tightening. People always forget the central bank in China has pulled in money from the system, which is equal to 50% of the GDP of the country, right? So the central bank of China's balance sheet is equal to something like 70% of the GDP of the country, right? So think of the U.S. having a balance sheet that's $11 trillion or $10 trillion, and right now the Fed's balance sheet is like $1.2 trillion. That's how much money the central bank of China has sucked in. And so China's trying to do its best to restrain liquidity. The U.S. has no choice but to continue. I think the European Central Bank is going to have to arrange some sort of Brady bond program for Europe, which is an exchangeable bond, which is, you know, call it, all these bonds can be bought by anybody, and they're going to be issued at 60 cents on the dollar of the old stuff. And this is going to result in real damage to European banks. So I think the European banks have got to go through a real bath before the end of the year.
Just beyond the follow-up to that interesting point, what I was thinking of, you're talking about loans, and you're using important statistics or data about loans. So are you, and you're talking about a very polarized world, the data that you have from China, for example, are you taking that as your for real, that's the picture that we're seeing in terms of credit? Some people are saying that there's huge piles of local debt piling up, for example.
Right. Well, there's three things you can say to that. First of all, I've been looking at China since 92, and what I just learned immediately off the bat when I used to go through that big fat yellow book, the China Statistical Yearbook, and I have to go through manually before, you know, there was anything out there. There was no internet. You would always want to get like five or six independent confirmations of one data point. And if there's consistency, you know I'm onto something. So I'm always looking for consistency. That's the first thing. The second thing is that if you don't like the numbers that you see internally, use the external numbers, and that's the net foreign assets. If you don't like the China numbers, try the IMF numbers. The net foreign assets show you beyond the shadow of a doubt that China is actually continuing to deleverage. As long as the net foreign assets of a country continue to rise, that is proof positive that China is actually, in fact, deleveraging, because your assets are going up faster than your liabilities. And that's been going up almost every single month, uninterrupted, for 48 months. The third part of this is that, again, I showed you five different ways to look at this. I looked at fair value of currencies, I looked at the current account, I looked at the consumption data, and I looked at the LDR. And that's a five-fold independent confirmation of data. And in all five of those, you have a pattern showing up. And that's what I wanted to show you today, that there's an unequivocal pattern here which shows you that this unbalanced world has a force which is going to force down asset prices in the West and force up asset prices in Asia.
We have a tremendous number of questions now. Over here, please identify yourself again. You know, we only have about 8 minutes left, so I want to see everyone who has a question so I can see how many I can get to. Everyone who does have a question, raise their hand. No one's raising their hand? They all disappeared. You have another one? Any over? Okay, take your time. Ask a long question. Attack Paul.
To Han Shi from South China Morning Post reporter.
Ask an 8-minute question, yeah.
Basically, you have already said that China's liability to asset ratio is not that bad. China's gearing ratio is a lot better than Europe and America. But my question is, there's a lot of concern over China's huge railway debt. Some economists say China's huge railway spending is creating unsustainable debt that will hurt its GDP growth and consumption going forward. What are your views on this?
Railway debt?
Yes. China's spending a lot of money on high-speed railway.
Yeah. Well, China's spending money on high-speed railways and big convention centers and lots and lots of stuff. There's one fact about banking. The only entity capable of creating a loan is a bank licensed in a fractional reserve banking system. There is no other thing that can create credit. And so every single one of those loans to the high-speed rail is a loan from a bank. And every single loan of a trust company is a loan from a bank. And so this whole issue of double counting is, I think, a canard. It is simply not true, and the only credit you can get comes from a fractional reserve bank, and the listed banks are basically something like 55% of the entire banking system of the country. And so we should look at that as a fairly representative number. If there is a lot of waste in investments like high-speed rail, that's going to show up at some point. My point is simply this, that when you have a loan-to-deposit ratio of 65%, you have a long, long way to go before those become problematic. That's my point. And when you get to 120, 125%, you know, the madness we were just talking about, you know, Dublin, you know, who on earth was you know, thinking that you could actually have, you know, that you could raise the number of homes per person in Ireland by 100% in 2 years and expect a tiny country like Ireland to fill it all up with 4 million people? Who in the hell was going to go live there? And in Ireland's case, all of that came from Europe. The external funding kills you. And China is entirely domestically funded. When you're externally funded and you have a problem, you're dead. And that's Brazil right now, Australia, right? Not China.
Let me just jump in. I don't really like to do this, but I was just at the BOAO forum where the head of Brazil was and the head of China was, et cetera. And this directly relates to, you know, there are things that you hear, and then there's the unscurrilous gossip that unfortunately I cannot report as part of The Economist. Right. But one of the things that I heard, and there seems to be some tension, is that the current head of Brazil was actually quite livid at the Chinese based on the following scenario. As you say, the Brazilian currency has really become very, very strong. This has been devastating for its industry. After all, it's trying to make things like planes that are competing with Chinese planes, where the currency is quite a bit cheaper. Plus, it's selling all those minerals to China, but based on dollars, and therefore not getting any more money for all the stuff that it's selling. So I understand, you know, I mean, the gossip was that in private discussions, she was saying, if you cannot do something about your currency, I will do something about your currency. Now, the question is, does Brazil have any ability to do anything to rectify what your charts show to be a clear imbalance?
Well, just very briefly, if you look at the credit the credit growth to GDP growth in Brazil over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years has been 2, almost equal to the U.S. The credit growth to GDP growth over the last 7 or 8 years is actually closer to 1. So Brazil has its own little credit monster, you know, popping up internally, totally independent of these other issues. And it's the excessive internal creation of credit in Brazil with super high interest rates that's causing the interest servicing of Brazil to be something like 24% in terms of the interest service compared to income. So these internal imbalances are really explosive for Brazil. And of course, any country when it's having problems, you know, who do you want to blame for your problems?
China.
Foreigners. the foreigners are, you know, it's their fault. And so I think the only people who are more livid than Brazil at the Chinese RMB is the Indians, who are making probably even louder noises behind the scenes than Brazil.
They didn't come.
See, yeah. So I think Brazil has its own set of problems, totally independent of the currency.
And do you think there's any, yeah, we'll do, yeah. For your last question, we'll take you. But is there anything Brazil can do about this besides rectify its own domestic problems? Does it have any international leverage in this situation? It could raise, actually, steel prices and stuff and see how that plays in Australia.
Yeah.
I'm sure Australia would like to do that as well.
Brazil can use the market and say, I'm sorry, we need to have a higher price for iron ore. Here's what it is. You can take it or leave it. And then China can play hardball with them. And but Brazil's largest trading partner is China right now. Right? China overtook, I forget, the U.S. as Brazil's largest trading partner. So Brazil needs to be really careful about, you know, making sure that its largest trading partner is happy.
Yeah, over here. I think that'll be the last question.
Jeremy Laws. I'm a headhunter. You've given your views on the Eurozone.
You can get my phone number in a second. one of my colleagues.
Cards.
Is
you've given your views on the Eurozone and what you feel they should be doing and what the Fed should be doing. And what China is doing. And you've told us. So what I'm saying is, go forward 10 years to 2021. What do you think these charts and the world will look like?
It's hard. I think that Barry Eichengreen had a great section in his book. Again, I highly recommend the book. Terrific book, Exuberant Privilege. You know. he makes a comparison to the UK in 1956 during the Suez Crisis, and where suddenly the UK woke up one day and it wasn't the superpower anymore, and the US basically literally told Anthony Eden, who was the Prime Minister during the Suez Crisis, and Harold Macmillan was the Foreign Secretary. I think John Foster Dulles basically told him, you get out of the Suez in 72 hours or we are going to trash your currency. You know, and the UK said, how dare you? And yes, we'll be out in 2 days. Give us some time. So that was the end of the British Empire, was 1956. And the UK had to get bailed out by the IMF. People forget that the UK needed to get bailed out by the IMF in the 1970s. And so basically, if you add up all the debt in the West, I would submit to you that it is virtually impossible to repay all of it. So if you're a government in the West, what is your next best option when you have those kinds of debt levels? You want to inflate it away. And so therefore, I think we're going to enter a period of inflation. Some people say this is not possible because the debt levels are just too large. But boy, oh boy, you know, when I was at Lehman Brothers, when Lehman collapsed, I just said the only way out is for the Federal Reserve to double its balance sheet. And nobody believed me. And lo and behold, the balance sheet was doubled like in 2 months. So Bernanke is not messing around. And I would just say that the title of my presentation for many, many months is basically, you know, this is the biggest poker game the world has ever seen. And the central banks have just put $9 trillion on the table. They're only going to walk away to go to the ATM machine. They are not walking away from the table. And if you think they're going to walk away, you are kidding yourselves. They've put $9 trillion down on that table, and they're not walking away. And so they basically are betting, making a $9 trillion bet on reflation, by the way, including China. And so we should probably not raise the ante on the central banks is my warning to all of you. So that's it. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think you got a very attractively priced lunch at the FCC. 10 years, it might be much more expensive to hire Mr. Schulte for that reason by itself. I know there are many people who want to come and speak to him, so if I think they take a photo. If you want to approach the podium after that, it would be great. Thank you very much. You've been a good audience. Wait a second. This is our contribution to commodity distribution. This is a present from the FCC.
Is it ticking?
It's ticking. Yeah. So we get a picture, I guess.
Okay.
You want to stand on the chair?